Yes, Thursday morning. Welcome, everyone. This is RPPFM across the Mornington Peninsula. Great to have your company just after 11 o'clock this Thursday morning. Hope you're doing well. Welcome to The Age Stage once again, a program which we've designed to look at issues affecting older Australians. Made possible, of course, with the generous support of the Village Glen in Rosebud, the Village Baxter at Frankston South, and Encore Living in Carrum Downs. I'm Brendan Telfer, and here with me is your host of The Age Stage, Vicky Barber.
Hello, Brendan. How are you?
Vicky, very, very well. Very, very happy.
Oh, well, that's always good. We like it when you're happy.
It's been a bit dark and damp and but I don't know.
But maybe there's going to be some snow in them there hills.
There could be. There could be. Anyway, looking forward to a big weekend. But we have a program ahead of us.
We do have
a very important program today, the Age Stage.
Another great episode of the Age Stage. So today we have special guests coming into the studio with us, Dr. Fergus McGee. And he's the medical head of advanced care planning for Peninsula Health. And we're going to discuss the concept of the living will.
Yes, indeed. A very important concept and some legislative action about this, not only later on this year, but also next year. So we'll be speaking to Fergus as well about that in the latter half of the program. But first, and more importantly, we have guests with us.
We do. We have Stuart back with us, of course, from Village Baxter. Hello, Stuart. How are you this week?
Hi, Stuart. How are you? Hi, Brendan.
Back in the house. Hello, Stuart. Good to see you again.
And this week we have Jane Luxford with us from the Village Glen in Rosebud. Hello, Jane. How are you?
Hello, Vicky. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming along today.
It's my pleasure.
I met Jane just recently, actually. I went down to do a little radio documentary down there at the facility, and Jane was down there, ensconced and out the back of an amazing facility. And Jane, welcome up here to our studio, to our part of the world.
Thank
good
you,
to
Brendan.
See you.
Very good to be here.
Lovely to see you.
Now, Jane, you're the manager there.
I'm the manager of the Village Glen, yes.
Yes, and how long have you been?
I have been at the Village now for 18 years and manager
Now, you're part of literally the family there.
I am,
as
yeah,
well.
Yes. So I've been manager for about 14 years.
Wonderful.
That's about right, 14 or 15 years. I'm the daughter of the owner, Chaz Jacobson, so I'm his daughter. So came to work. I had a legal background and came to work there when a position became available some 18 years ago, and have been there ever since.
But well, you obviously enjoy it.
I do. I love it.
But you're not alone, Jane. I mean, most of your staff have all got a similar record, haven't they?
Do.
Their CVs
yeah.
are incredible.
They
You've
are,
all
yeah.
been there for at least 10 years.
Yes.
The majority of you, and more.
And I'm sure Stuart's Village is the same. It engenders loyalty to work for our residents, and not just for my father, but for them as well. It's a very rewarding job. There's no question. So I've been there for that long. We've got someone that's been there 19 years, 17 years. We've got an employee that's worked for us who we love and adore, who's been there for over 35 years.
Wow.
So it is a family,
father.
Even if it's not by blood, by
it
the
is.
Sounds
I,
of
I
it.
Call it, there is the Jacobson family, but there's also the Village Glen family.
That's how we very much think of
our staff.
And obviously your residents too.
And our residents, very much so. So I've got a brother that's just joined us a year ago, so he's in sales. One of my daughters works on the reception. Another daughter just has been with us previously but has just joined us again. She's coming to a marketing role. So, and I've got nieces and nephews, a little younger. But, there's opportunities there for the family. It's very much a family business.
Absolutely.
Jane, I'm interested. What happened for the first 4 years? Did you have to do an apprenticeship?
I came along as I was employed as assistant manager. And through various situations, after John Brown, I came in that role and had that role for about 3 or 4 years, and then situations evolved that he appointed me village manager, and I've been there ever since.
I reckon it was an apprenticeship. you had to prove yourself, Jane.
She obviously has.
Otherwise,
done
out the door.
Well.
So I love it. I mean, it is an extremely rewarding role. We all think that in the office. I'm sure Stuart's staff is the same. You get back what you put in 100-fold.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You've really got to admire. I mean, it is a true family business in every sense of a word, Village Glen. And, you know, it's such a rarity in the modern world to have that. And I just reckon it's a fantastic story. Mm. Absolutely fantastic.
Mm. Well,
and I didn't realise you had so many rallies.
Mm. No, there's a few more behind.
They keep coming out of the woodwork.
We've got our youngest of my father's grandchildren is 10 and 12, so they're still coming, and we've got more in between. So, yeah.
That's why you keep on expanding.
Of course, yeah, that's what it was all about.
You've got to provide jobs for family. It is a really, really good story.
Oh, you know, it's a wonderful story here on the picture.
Having watched it grow over the 30 years, or 31 years now, you know, it is quite remarkable just the journey that the village Glen has gone through. And to his credit, I mean, Chaz has been there for a whole time. He would probably know every nail in the building. And when one fails, he probably wants to get a warranty claim in. But, you know...
He knows him well.
We do. But, you know, it is just a really, really good story.
Well, what about you personally, Jane? I mean, transitioning out from, you know, a very influential dad, very, very, very influential in the area, and seeing him in that work environment. Did that take time?
It does, yeah. There is an adjustment.
And seeing him in that professional role and, you know, that reverence that everybody seems to have for him in the industry. I'm not just talking about down here on the peninsula, but sort of nationally as well.
Yeah, it was. It's different. You have to have. There is the work hat, and then you leave it. And even if you've had a bad day at the office, or things have happened that you know that has made that day difficult, you see each other that night for a family function, and you just got to leave it at the door. You just have to. You really do have to separate those different roles, and that's like you learn through that. That's part of the 18 years of learning.
I'm sensing they have a pie fight once a week,
just to get it all
but,
out.
Yeah. But it's you try not to take the family business to work. It's just, you know, and likewise, my daughters have joined the business, and there's a business component, there's a professional side of it, and then there's the family side.
And they in turn would have to be respecting you, because you as manager would be seeing elements of the business probably that they could only glimpse, but you know the fundamentals, the nuts and bolts, the personal issues, the privacy issues, the legal issues as well, given your background.
Yeah, so they want to learn all that, as you know, and be across all those details. That'll take time. It takes time to learn. And we are, you know, we've evolved over a long period of time, but this business is, you know, we have aged care next door to us, Tea Tree. We're building at Mornington. There's other developments that are going. This business is growing. So, you know, it was the Village Glen for such a long time, and then we got into aged care, and that's a much, much different...
Much to everyone's surprise.
Yeah.
Chaz said he would never get into aged care over his dead body.
He did say
and
that.
And he's a new age guy and has come on board, which equally is interesting, because retirement villages, you know, go back 20 years, really saw themselves as resort developments.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst I would stand up and try and convince people otherwise that, you know, your resort lifestyle people are actually going to get older and they're going to get frailer, and then what are you going to do with them?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they're not all going to be jumping out on the golf course each day, and you need to actually consider the future. And, you know, I still have the bruises that were inflicted upon me from making such comments. But, you know, as the industry has matured, it is the obvious thing for people to do. And say, to Chaz's credit, you know, why do one when you can do multiple? And if you've never seen Tea Tree down there, it is spectacularly beautiful.
He doesn't do things by heart.
It is spectacularly beautiful. Believe me, I have seen Tea Tree. Yeah. Vicky, have you been down
there?
No,
I haven't been down there. I'll have to come and visit Jane and her team.
It is absolutely an amazing facility. It truly is. People have to get in there and have a look
when
at Tea Tree.
When he does it. Right, doesn't he?
Stuart, you know, and there's little stories. You know, when you walk in and you just see the waterfall and the chandelier, I mean, they're the obvious things. But, you know, there's many little kitchenette areas, and each one has a different splashback with a different theme on it. And, you know, and why would you do that when the obvious thing to do is to buy 10 of the same or whatever you're going to do? But everyone is actually different. And my personal favourite is Chaz actually redesigned a window for use in a building, where the good old louver window, which has really gone out of fashion in the modern world.
Oh, it's come back in.
But Chaz designed it so the louvers were down the bottom, so you get an airflow down the bottom of the window without obstructing the view. And I thought that is really creative.
Mm.
And this is not the Village Glen half hour.
No.
but it is a really good story.
Yes.
And
one of success on the peninsula as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, we wanted to talk to you today, Jane, about the experience of when someone comes in as a new resident.
But and I think that's a marvellous idea, Vicky. But I tell you what, why don't we go for a break now?
Quick break and
then
we'll come
then
back.
We can come back and talk about the new experience, the new resident, and what it means to move in on your first day in the village. What do you think about
that idea?
Sounds
good. Thanks, Brendan.
I'm going to run the machine and we'll get right back to you. This is The Age Stage across the Mornington Peninsula and beyond on 98.7, 98.3 RPPFM. You're listening to The Age Stage on RPPFM. Brendan Telfair in the studio with you alongside of Vicky Barber. The Age Stage is made possible with the generous support of the Village Glen in Rosebud, the Village Baxter in Frankston South and Encore Living in Carrum Downs. Here's your host of The Age Stage, Vicky Barber.
Now, before the break, we were talking with Jane Luxford from Village Glen and we were asking her about what it's like to move into retirement village, like from day one, what sort of experience can someone expect and what sort of programs do you have in place?
Well, it's a busy day, obviously.
I could imagine.
So, it's a daunting thing for all new residents, I'm sure, to move in. What I wanted to talk about was a program or programs that we've put in place that have really evolved over the years in the village and listening to our residents in how they have experienced that first move in, that first day, the first days, the first week, the first month, whatnot. So we had what we thought we were rolling along and involving our residents and integrating our residents into the Village Glen. And it took a resident to talk to Peter, who comes onto this program, obviously, and to tell him that she wasn't feeling very welcomed, as welcomed as she had hoped. She had expectations, which she was entitled to have.
Yes.
So, and Peter stopped, as you do, and you listen to her, and it was really something that was really quite upsetting her, and it really made us as an organisation, as a management, stop and think that, okay, we can be doing more about this. We need to be seeing our residents as, which we do see them as, you know, extremely important. They come in, it's a very busy occasion. What can we do to, from that very first day, to help them integrate, to evolve into Village Glen residents? And part of it's the reason that we do what we do, let's face it. So,
because it is a big change for someone coming from home into that situation, and so I suppose they could be feeling overwhelmed as well.
This lady was by herself. Often it's a bit easier when it's a couple, but not always. Not always. Just because you're a couple, can you feel welcomed or feel that you are part of something immediately? It does take time. It depends if you know people in the village. A lot of our residents move in through word of mouth. They know friends that have, you know, we have occasions, I'm sure Stuart does, that residents move in and they are one of, because they know a friend who's moved in, and then all of a sudden we've got five groups of friends that have moved in over a year's
and the
period
networkers.
And it just keeps going.
The residents sell the village.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, they really do. So in this instance, so we took it back to our staff and we had a couple of staff meetings and took this story to our staff and we thought, well, what do we do now? What can we do that's better? It's okay. The first day that they move in, as we all, I'm sure we've all moved house along the journey, and you move in and you're in chaos. Mm-hmm. And the boxes are there, and who can find the kettle, who can find the cup of coffee, who can find anything. So,
let alone the tea bag itself.
Let alone the tea bag. So we started off simply by providing what we call the new resident tray. So it's a tray, and I'm sure lots of places do it. It's got a kettle, which is borrowed. They don't keep the kettle. We do go and pick it up again. There's tea and coffee, there's milk, there's and we also provide a lunch. And depending on whether there's one or two is to the size of what we provide, and it's sandwiches or it's something else, there's cakes, there's whatever. So it's a tray.
To get them through that
first day of not having to hunt those things up, and we give them a bottle of champagne as well.
Oh, wonderful.
That's evolved to, we also give them now champagne glasses with the Village Glen stamp engraved into it, so that's evolved over the journey. And we provide them with the things on that very first day that we think that they might need, and that's been very well received, as I'm sure some people have their own lunch, they don't need it, but they might have it for dinner. And that's been really well received. And we also get a visit from what we call, or what we decide to put into place, was a Village Glen buddy.
Right.
So every resident has a buddy. At the very start of our program, we had about three or four of us in the office that were buddies. In the end, it has ended up being a person responsible for our new residents in our office at Stonna.
So it's an individual person, and they're responsible for every new resident?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they go out and talk to, introduce themselves to the new resident. This is a tray which should be set up and is set up and waiting in the villa or the apartment waiting for them. Donna makes herself available, introduces herself. Okay, we've got an information booklet, a folder that they get, and it's got all the information, which is far too much to take in one day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that introductory on the first day. Our nurse goes, we've got Division 1 nurses in the village. She goes along just to introduce herself, orientates them to our nurse call and whatnot.
That was going to be my question.
Here we are. They orientate them to the nurse call.
Jane.
Yes. And so we leave them alone for that first day, first couple of days, and then we follow up. The nurse follows up at some stage about three or four days, a week later, to take a medical history. So there's that part of it. But then Donna will go back and she'll go with them, sit down with a cup of tea, go through our folder. What are the things that you need to know about? If they're not familiar with the area, she'll get them in the car, drive them around, show them the bank, show them the doctors, the hospital, all the chemists, mm-hmm. the supermarket, all the things that they need to know yeah. about. So there's that part of it. So those things, and she will follow up with them depending on what their need is. So mm-hmm. some residents, if we're a couple, we are right. Thank you very much. It's fine. We know people, we're right. There's other people you need to put a lot of time into, which mm-hmm. is fine. They expect that, they deserve it. It's what we're about because we care. I mean, at the end of the day,
everyone
cares.
Do you have other residents who will go and visit them on that first day? So, you know, Marjorie in 219 or...
Well, she will. Neighbours will do that anyway. The other visit that they get, be it the first day or the second day, will be from a member of our residents committee who also will invite them to dinner. Dinner or lunch with them that we take them along, and I'm sure you do something similar. So every aspect of the village, I suppose, the nursing, the management, and the residents are front and centre, I suppose, on those mm-hmm. first few days, which is important. So that's evolved, and that's been something that's been really well received. And as I say, each individual resident, it depends on what their need is as to what we can give them the time that they need. That's what they get. So,
and if a resident did turn up and were a little bit more independent and really did not want to engage it's entirely up to them as well.
It is totally up to them. And we respect their privacy, of course.
And what about the lady that did have the reservations about the original welcome and Peter took it on board, changed the system, and it's totally reformed now, and she's happy, or
she recognised, and she did find out, obviously, that from that came... A lot of
progression.
Good. I mean, you just got to. I mean, and it's empathy, isn't it? It's putting yourself in the position of, okay, what would I want? What would I want for my mother? What would I want for my father? How would I want them to be treated? And it's not that we didn't do things before. It's just that needed to be a more concerted, focused effort mm-hmm. to, okay, what is the program? We also put in place what we call our new residents meeting. So once a month, on the last Thursday of the month, for the residents for the previous 12 months that have moved in, they get an invite. It's in their newsletter, but they also get a personal invite to come mm-hmm. to this meeting.
So that would be this time next week. The new resident meeting would be happening.
Yep, it would
last Thursday of the month.
Last Thursday of the month, that's right. And every month there is somebody, we bring someone along different to speak about something different in the village. So I might talk about a service that we provide. It might be we talk about our service fee, or our nurse comes along to talk about what they provide to our residents. We very much involve other residents that mm-hmm. do come along. So we might have one month might be all about our clubs. So a member of our golf club comes, our croquet club, our bowls club. They come along and they talk to residents. Another one, it might be all our exercise groups. So we might get someone that's involved in our gym program, or our water aerobics program, or our chair exercises program, or whatnot. We get them to come and talk. The best thing for me is what I love to sit back Well, the first thing when I introduce a new residents meeting, who hasn't been there before, so mm-hmm. I ask them, and everyone then has to listen to me because I say it every time we go. And what this the best thing that I love about those meetings when I walk into it is because I deliberately am about 5 or 10 minutes late to it because I want them to sit
to start chatting.
And I want them to chat, and we have tea and coffee and the biscuits and all the rest of it. And the thing I love the most is walking in there and just hearing, and I have to, like, come on, guys. I've got to yell. Come on, enough. It's my turn now.
Keep them under control.
Keep them under control.
Whoop them into
shape. That's what this is about. It's about meeting new people in the same position as you, somebody that understands where you're coming from, hopefully to make new connections, new whatever, and that's what I love about that meeting. So, and I explain how at every meeting, every month that we have, about how this evolved and why we do these things, and this mm-hmm. is about getting them to connect not just with us but to learn about our the village and what we're about and the people that are involved. But the best thing that I love about it is when other residents speak and they sell them. Think you made a comment, Stuart, that they're our best salesmen, seriously.
They
love it.
Again, Jane, I came down to do this thing, and I tell you what, every person I spoke to down there at your facility, just total endorsement mm-hmm. of what they were doing, their lifestyle, choices, opportunities, they just absolutely adored it,
mm-hmm.
every single mm-hmm. one of them.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the interesting thing about that, Brendan, is most people don't understand what living in a village is all about.
True.
Of course.
And you know, it really is an eye-opener for so many people who come in and see it firsthand. Because, you know, it does take you back to a period of time where you knew your neighbours. We've had that discussion before.
Yes,
you now know your neighbours again. And you'll do things together as neighbours.
It's the old-fashioned community that we and our parents and our grandparents grew up with.
Mm.
It's so evident, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, they are just remarkable places which, you know, as we said last week, that, you know, villages only look after 5% or provide accommodation for 5% of a population. And it is rare that you find someone who is not happy living in a village. And if you're not happy, then there could be a variety of reasons. And most times we want happy clients. So if you're not happy, we will sort that for you, or we'll give you your money back, or whatever you want. You know, we don't want anyone to be disadvantaged. If you think you've made a bad decision, then, you know, we can fix that problem. You know, we don't want people to sit there and think, this is the worst thing I've ever done, because reality is it can be the greatest time of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because, Jane, this started really with your dad wanting to provide for his mum, really, wasn't it? Wasn't that his motivation?
His motivation was, that's right.
So it goes back to your grandmother, really, this whole thing. I mean, that's basically where the thread goes, doesn't it?
He wanted to provide for his mother, who she wasn't with us when the village was first thought about and certainly was built, where would he want? And it comes back to what I was talking about, the empathy. What would you do? What do you want to do for your parent? What do you want to do? How would you like to live? What do you? And that's, I mean, everybody's got that in them to understand about how do you want to live? How do you want to treat people? How do you want to be treated yourself? So that's what this comes to, and it's and you know, making sure that our residents feel part connected and part of it from the very start is extremely important. And you know, we work hard to do that. We part of that is making ourselves available all the time to be, if anyone's got any issues, to have that connection, to have that relationship with residents, either through, it might be that a resident might connect with one of the girls on the front, or Sonia, who does our maintenance, or Donna, her buddy, or as long as there's a connection and there's a relationship and that's built. And I think, you know, whoever that's with, that's important. But the door's always open and we're always available for them, provided we're not in another meeting.
I think you've shown that by not only listening to this particular woman who wasn't happy with her experience, experience, so to speak, and took it on board and did something about it. And then from her perspective, she's probably quite impressed as well, saying, here they are, they've done something positive and I'm now enjoying myself, and she's probably telling everybody else
and not,
as well.
Look, not everything's perfect. Not everything.
No, we would never claim to be perfect. No. Never.
Everything can be
improved.
We're
all human.
Yeah, exactly.
And humans will never be perfect people.
Mm. So, you know, you try hard. Yes, you do try hard. And everyone's heart, I firmly believe, and I'm sure, I know you'll concur, that people that work in aged care, be it retirement living, aged care, community, very special people that work in aged care.
They're certainly not in it for the money, Jane. No.
Well, Jane and Stuart, thank you so much for coming in today. Jane, thank you for coming
pleasure.
In.
A debut performance.
Yes,
outstanding, Jane Luxford. Brilliant. Good. Thank you very much indeed.
He needs Peter.
It's my pleasure.
And thank you, Stuart, for coming back again.
You're suggesting we dump Peter going forward?
No.
How could we dump Peter? But Jane, it was fabulous. You see, it wasn't that hard at all, was it? It was just beautiful.
Thank you.
Jane
thank
Luxford,
you
manager of Village Glen, thank you so much indeed. This is The Age Stage across the Mornington Peninsula. We'll be right back after this break.
Peninsula Radio, 98.7, 98.3 FM.
RPFM 98.7, 98.3 across the Mornington Peninsula, coming up to 25 minutes to 12 o'clock this Thursday morning. Great to have your company. This is The Age Stage, a program which looks at issues affecting older Australians, made possible with the generous support of the Village Glen in Rosebud, the Village Baxter in Frankston South, of course, on-call living in Carrum Downs. I'm Brendan Telfer. Your host of the program is Vicky Barber.
Thanks, Brendan. Now, we have another guest in the studio this morning. And this is Dr. Fergus McGee, and he is the Medical Head of Advanced Care Planning for Peninsula Health. Welcome, Dr. McGee. How are you?
Good afternoon, Brendan. Good
day.
Can we call you Fergus?
Yep, Fergus is fine.
Fergus.
Now, today we wanted to talk about a number of different aspects, but you sent a note to us which sort of outlined awareness of a patient's choices and wishes when they're coming in for a procedure or some sort of medical treatment. And to be more upfront in that interaction with healthcare, and that there's some steps involved in achieving some goals for more involvement for decisions from the actual individual in regards to their health. Can you tell us a little bit about that that particular aspect?
So the program that comes under the wider program of community care at Peninsula Health, which is run by Peninsula Health as a community health program. It includes the advanced care planning, but actually it's a little bit wider than that. It involves all the end of life issues and palliative care sort of situations that crop up as people either go through an event or a bad illness or come towards that stage in their life when those things start to crop up. Obviously age is one of those things. And obviously as part of that process, you can see by the way the community has been driving a lot of these discussions during the last few years that they have wanted more of a say. And I recognise that's something that possibly as a medical profession we've been a little bit slow to take on board and to really sort of allow that to happen sometimes. My background is obviously using advanced care plans for 20 years in my own private practice, in a country practice, just by peculiarities of just being one practice.
Right.
So it's quite I'm used to using it, but it's something that is not so common or so regularly used in a more metropolitan sort of practice.
Okay. Now, is this something that it's part of pre-planning then?
It is. It's pre-planning. It's about the patient's having a discussion with their family, I suppose, to start with, having a discussion with their main carer, having a discussion with their doctor, especially their local doctor, their GP. And I suppose probably when things get bad, when you go to hospital, those people may or may not be available or around at that time. And by creating what some people call a living will or an advanced care directive or an advanced care plan, they're all basically terminology for you documenting what you would like to happen if these things happen to you and you can't speak for yourself.
Right. So it's a formalised plan, so to speak, that you've written down, you've signed off and people are aware of.
Yes. So I brought one for you to have a look at as a little copy, and you can just see the sort of questions that they are on the form. And this is the form that we've developed with a lot of community consultation around the Mornington Peninsula over the last 3 to 5 years. The previous clinician that was heading us up, Joe Della, has done a lot of work with the community, and we have lots of focus groups with the community asking what they would like on this form. And a lot of the structure of the form has been decided by that community involvement.
So, Fergus, where did this initiative really come from? I mean, basically, basically it went down to an inquiry that set a few parameters around this whole thing about 4 years ago.
Yes.
But where was the initiative coming from? Was it coming from the people? Was it the voice of the people? Or was this a health carers and providers initiative? Was it a consensus of both? Or
I think it's. I think a lot of the drive was coming from the community. I think that certain groups in the community felt they wanted to have a voice, and possibly over the last 20, 25 years, the sort of way that people interact with their doctor has changed a little bit, and the sort of the ability for the patient to voice their wishes and have their choices strengthened and actually more important and valued more is something that has evolved over the last 25 years with medical practice. But we weren't quite up to speed when it came to the situation when they were not competent or when they were unconscious.
So this can speak for them,
yes,
so to speak.
Yes.
So this is basically care and management of a patient in their later years or on the later stages of a terminal illness.
So you can do this plan anytime.
So I could do one today if I wanted to.
Exactly. And it can change. And of course, you can do one today and you can change it in 2 years, 5 years, if things change for you, or you can leave it as it is until things change.
Right.
And of course, if you go into hospital and you're sick, you can still speak for yourself. Then it doesn't override your wishes.
Right, of course.
So it doesn't take precedent over your own. If you get a hold of the document says, or the computer says, you have an advanced care plan saying this, you know, you can say, I've changed my mind.
Right.
And you are entitled to do that. So that's definitely the case. But yeah, so it's, but obviously it's probably more acutely needed as you get older and as you get frailer and you have certain conditions and illnesses obviously are degenerative. I mean, obviously a lot of the lobby groups around MS and motor neuron disease, they're very much involved in this process.
Right.
Because obviously they see the need is inevitable for them in an almost predictable sort of time frame. So they've been very involved in the end of life discussions around advanced care plans, power of attorneys, guardianship, and also around the issues of palliative care and end of life choices. So those groups are very involved for that reason.
At its most extreme form, this would be sort of voluntary euthanasia as well, would it not?
No, this is all about the patient's choices around what is legal and acceptable practice in Australia or Victoria.
Is that definition of legal practice changing to a point whereby euthanasia could be considered as an endpoint?
So I think that the two things are separate for good reasons. I mean, the end-of-life choices around, you know, palliative care and being kept comfortable and where you want to be, which are really important things for most people. They want to be at home most of the time, they want to be kept comfortable, they want their family around. Those sort of things are all really things that are covered over by the advanced care plans, advanced care directives. The separate discussion, which is happening at the same time, obviously, and is now going to be up for a discussion in Parliament about more things that step outside those the present legislation around an end-of-life choices with physician-assisted suicide, etc. That is a separate discussion. It is going to be separate legislation and is, although the conversation is connected, they are completely separate processes. This is for anyone. That's possibly going to be for a very select group of people.
Right.
This is for anyone. And obviously this is for people that aren't necessarily sick or dying or in any doubt that they're okay at the moment, but they might to plan for the future so that they may be more concerned about their choices being verbalized for them in the future. Maybe they haven't got a person they can really give that responsibility to. Maybe they don't feel that that's a fair burden for their spouse to take. All those reasons are valid and good reasons. So they document it down, and then that takes the burden off the family, takes the burden off the medical staff looking after them, and actually it's starting from a position of actually knowing what the patient thought at that time, which is sometimes not easy to find out when you're sick.
Now, is this centralised? I know you're working with Peninsula Health on this particular initiative, but if I'm not on the peninsula, so to speak, is there a centralised database, or the individual might have one of these plans, but then they're away somewhere else? Do they just say, "Oh, I have one of these plans in place"? Or
so some of this is funded by Victorian Health, and it is across the whole state.
All right.
But obviously, so a lot of the forms will be very similar from place to place. But obviously, there are area health authorities, and obviously one of the issues that is transferring information between health authorities is not straightforward. So therefore, when we do this process, we put one on the system at Peninsula Health. We give a copy to the patient, and we sometimes ask them if they want other copies to disseminate to their family members, etc. And we generally say that if you're going to go to hospital, you take the copy with you, just in case they go to another hospital, buy it, you know, the ambulance takes them to somewhere else.
To somewhere else that's not within this.
So there
this
is no area. Central repository at the moment, but I think with the new legislation coming through next year, there will be an attempt to get that centralisation.
So that may happen. Be part of a long-term plan, so to speak.
It makes sense for Victoria to have its own record of that.
So are we progressive down here in terms of advancing this discussion on the peninsula?
I think the discussion... I think so. And I think...
I mean, if legislation is looking to catch up with maybe where we're at down here, is that the case?
I think the legislation is catching up with where the community has been for a few years, to be honest.
Well, are we communicating that expression better down here on the Mornington Peninsula than elsewhere in Victoria, would you argue, or not?
I can't comment elsewhere in Victoria. As I said, where I worked, we've used them for 20 years, but that was a peculiarity of the nurse in the hospital and myself discussing it and saying this is appropriate and asking the patients, basically. That's all we did. I think Victoria is on a par with some other states. The legislation is a bit varied from state to state, and that's one of the issues. But I know that the legislation that's coming through next year for Victoria is going to recognise that people might transfer from Queensland, and they're going to look at those in good faith.
Right.
And the same thing has been reciprocated to other states. So there is obviously differences to the legislation, but there's an inherent value in the information that's on the document, and most states would recognise other states' documents. But they're not the same legal basis.
Traditionally in Australia, there are some more conservative states than others, or territories.
Yes.
Is that going to be a factor, perhaps, as we start to nationalise this discussion?
I think most of the states are on a similar path of various legislative stages. There's not a huge difference in the overall legislation, but there are some particular differences. That's all about terminology and wording and some slight differences. And obviously there's a little bit more concern in some places about the connection with physician-assisted suicide that you've mentioned before. I see them as two separate things. Most people do. But obviously the conversation can't be separated completely.
And in the public's mind, that separation, there's a distinction that the public might lose, or indeed the popular press might lose, because there could be some fear and loathing stories. As the feds get into this, does the discussion get a little bit more blurry, do you think, as the federal government gets involved, or are we...
Well, you'd hope that with the same with lots of other health regulations that are carried across all the states, there are obviously there's national regulation sort of legislation which has been transferred from being a state-based medical registration or nursing registration that's now been transferred to a national regulation system, and that was adopted some years ago, and that's quite effective in standardising a lot of those regulation issues, and I think this is something that's going to fall into that sort of category.
So legislation then later on this year and next, or is it purely next year that we're going to be seeing this discussion?
The legislation for advanced care plan and the medical treatment and decisions Act has passed and will be enacted in March of next year.
Right.
I think the other issues around euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide is only up for debate at this stage.
Basically, this examination and this consensus statement was drawn upon, and there was a group put together to basically look at this and sort of chart its future. Where were these people drawn from? Who was the resource that you turned to look at all this?
So the parliamentary committee that drove a lot of this discussion had wide, if you look through the actual books they've produced, there's a lot of community consultation, a lot of groups that are involved in this area, a lot of stakeholders that are actually involved in delivering the care, and a lot of the groups who have a vested interest in this, as the groups I've said before, whose clients have a disease that's degenerative. They're very involved in this. A lot of the advocacy groups for the aged care have been involved in this. And I think that's all appropriate. And I think the consultation was very good. It was very broad. And I thought the documents they produced where they were stressing about palliative care being very important were all very important.
I agree. I mean, it reads absolutely beautifully and very, very well considered.
Yes.
And I see basically the sort of the 10 principles or the 10 fundamentals that they talk about as well in terms of providing this care for these people. Interesting, isn't it? Palliative care, of course, and a very heavy emphasis. emphasis on that. You yourself, Fergus, having worked in this area or seen this idea grow over the last decade or so, are you happy where the conversation now is in terms of a greater acceptance of this discussion?
Oh, much happier. If I gave a talk in my first year in Peninsula Health about patients who were in aged care who had medical problems who were coming to hospital, and my standard management from my country practice, I felt I was landing on a different planet because I couldn't work out what was happening with the aged care. And I gave this talk and tried to sort of, you know, suggest that possibly this wasn't what the aged people wanted, because the medicalization of some of the problems had created an issue where we weren't actually asking always what the patient wanted. And that was something I felt needed to change. This discussion is much further advanced, and that whole importance of the patient choice is much further ahead now and much more embedded in Peninsula Health, for example. I can't speak for the other health authorities, but certainly for Peninsula Health, it's embedded in our processes to ask and actually look for these issues and look for these this information and talk to the patients about their wishes.
So what's the first step? Is it usually when I am actually in hospital or going for treatment? Is that traditionally when this is sort of discussed, filled out and everyone's aware of it? Or if I was to take the first step, where would I go to do this? Okay.
So I think the first step would be, as I said, talk to your family, because they need to know, because they'll be asked at the time when, even if this document exists, they'll still be asked often what's going
on. But is the document through my GP, or can I jump online?
You can go online, and there are things you can access online to help you start the process. I think it's appropriate for the local GP to be your first port of call to discuss the document, answer any questions that you might have about what the terminology might
mean. Yes, because I'm looking through the document and I'm thinking it's clearly written, but there are some things there which I'm sure you need a medical background to follow.
I'd approach your GP first as the first point of call. And then I think that's in the community. You approach your GP or health provider that you might have a lot of contact. A lot of community nurses would have a lot of information about this area. A lot of community health services would have information on this area and be able to give you advice. I think that's primarily where the person that is well and not necessarily facing something impending would go to.
Yes.
I think that if you have big issues, that will be time to talk to your GP about that, or your specialist about how you would handle what is going to happen to you in the future.
Right.
And then use that information to
then go through and actually fill the form.
So my role in the Peninsula Health is I see that the people were arriving at the hospital and that we didn't know what their wishes were, and I felt that we would be slow to get that information, and I think that it's the legislation is much stronger in making us do that, and that's a big improvement in the recent legislation. But also, we need that information to help the patient make a decision, and that informed discussion between us and the patient, where they give consent to whatever we'd like to do to make them feel better, really would be helped by having a sort of starting point like this to work from, especially if the person is frail, maybe a little bit unwell, maybe the family's distressed, and therefore this document gives you a very nice ground into where to start. We didn't have that all the time. In our local area, our aged care facility patients were running about 18%, which was standard across Australia, standard across the world, in fact. And I think since we've been instituting this sort of education and rolling out programs to the facilities, some of our aged care facilities are hitting 80%. Right. And our average is getting well over the 25%. So we're getting some change in the numbers, but when they come to hospital, still less than half will have a document that we can use. Right. I'd like to see it be more like 75%.
Yes.
Come with a document.
Right. Or so to have access to a document.
Have access to it.
Now, you mentioned before that if I'm coherent, I can speak and I can say my wishes, and my wishes might be different to what's on the form.
Yes.
But if I can't, this will override my partner or my whoever else that may be there, and emotional and all the rest of it. Does this make the final decision on their behalf?
So at the moment, and this was one of the problems with the previous legislation, is the moment the legal grounding, there's a certain amount of evidence and information on the form which should inform the doctor as what he says is the appropriate thing to do, and that should obviously inform your family members as well.
Right.
But because its legal standing was not quite so clear, it was sometimes not used for that reason, and that has been one of the criticisms from the community, that they were documenting these things but they weren't looked at, weren't enacted, and I think that was a correct criticism. The new legislation, I think, has dealt with a lot of those issues and is now a legal binding document. document for things that you specify specific issues
so
in the document.
Attorney comes back to me, the patient. I'm not giving it away, my powers of attorney.
No.
Comes back to me in that critical medical circumstance.
Yes.
I call the shots.
Yes.
I predetermine those shots.
Yes.
And intervention or non-intervention is determined by me at some stage before that critical moment. That's
yes.
how it works.
Yes, and especially if you specify a condition you have now and what you want done with that condition in the future. And the legislation has allowed for the fact that some people seeing a patient will say, okay, but this particular condition now doesn't fit exactly with what they've written down from before. So there's two parts of the legislation about specific things you have now that you do not want to have done in the future or managed in the future, like resuscitation, or I don't want to have chemotherapy, or etc. As opposed to things which are more values, where you say, I want to be kept comfortable, and I want to have my family around, I prefer to be at home, those sort of issues. So if a condition, what the legislation says now is if the actual specific condition is not replicated exactly in the future, but there's a very clear bit of information there, it should be transferred into the other part to say, okay, it's not exactly the same situation. You can't say you can't do it, but you've got to use it to inform the discussion with the patient, which is a massive change because it allows that grey area of discussion to occur without the information being dumped.
Right, right.
I'm a grumpy old man. I have an episode, and I say to everybody before I write this thing up, oh, I don't want to be revived or something, and I am revived. What right of redress do I have to those that I wrote the?
You can take this fairly, bluntly, and say that if you've written not for resuscitation and you're resuscitated, then of course, you know, the word assault will come up. And the new legislation where it becomes a legally binding document, you've specifically said, if I have a cardiac arrest, I do not want you to try and resuscitate me, and you do, there is liability there.
But here I am, a perfectly functioning human being. I've had my X number of stents put in. You brought me back from the brink.
Yes.
I am vertical. I'm functioning.
Yes.
I'm completely coherent.
Yes.
I did write the living will, but you have revived me. Nevertheless, despite the fact that you brought me back, I do have right of redress, do I?
You do. And I think that
be a grumpy old man.
Yes. You might not be improved on.
Yeah.
I think it's unlikely to go to court. I think that there's a potential for it to go to court. It's never been tested as far as I'm aware, because obviously the person doing that probably would have been acting in good faith of trying to make you better.
Mm.
And therefore the court's probably going to look at it in that respect. But it is a line in the sand that at some stage may be tested.
Hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it brings up all sorts of moral, philosophical considerations, legislative, legal as well, and also a fundamental document that you sign as a doctor in your first stages, your Hippocratic Oath.
Yes.
You know, what defines care in this instance?
So it's interesting you say that, because obviously, so the first thing, you can't, in an advanced care directive in the legislation, you can't refuse palliative care. So being kept comfortable cannot be refused by a document. So if a doctor sees you in distress, he has to give you, he wants to give you medication to feel comfortable. Your documents cannot exclude that.
Right.
And that's covered in the legislation. As far as the Hippocratic Oath, it says first do no harm and try and keep people alive. It also says things around a good death in the Hippocratic Oath as well.
Right.
And Hippocrates' teaching covered a whole bunch of stuff around making sure that people are dignified in the last stages of their life. And he also said things like, first do no harm, but if you need to do something emergency, then you do emergency things as well. He had a whole very, very good perspective on the fact that it wasn't always straightforward. And he definitely did not exclude keeping a person comfortable when they're dying.
And my very staunch religious convictions, well, I suppose I don't even go anywhere near the document in the first place. Then I just basically trust my future and my destiny to my God rather than to you, the doctor, I guess.
Well, you can specify in the document that you want everything to be done and you want that to be decided by fate or your religious beliefs, God would decide it, and you can specify that in the document.
Within the document.
Yes, it's not my choice. It's not, when I sign it, I'm signing the patient has signed it, and I'm signing the patient is competent, and it's always assumed competent unless obviously otherwise obvious. I'm not commenting on their judgment, on their decisions. I'm just simply attesting to that.
Yes. So is there a line for competency?
Yes, the legislation clearly states that competency is assumed unless there's a good reason to think it's not assumed. And there's good reason for that, because obviously it'd be easy for someone to say, my grandmother or mother is not competent, and then they're a bit confused and a little bit memory's not so good, but they still may be very capable of telling you, I would rather die at home.
Yes.
I would rather be, this would not be the treatment I would like. So therefore, it's saying, even if they are not perfectly competent, they may still have some role to play, yes, in their decisions. And that's where the onus is on you, saying, now, some people clearly are too confused, too cognitively impaired, and not able to sign a document like this. There is another document which says, for a patient who's not competent, and a power of attorney or substitute decision maker can complete that form for the patient.
On their behalf, yes, so to speak. Right.
Fergus, fascinating stuff, and maybe we're going to have to invite you back,
yes,
to examine a little bit more as the legislation comes through and we, yes, see a little bit more of it. But we thank you very much indeed for your time today.
No worries,
thank you very much, Fergus.
That.
Very interesting conversation.
Fascinating. Dr. Fergus McGee, thank you very much indeed, is the Medical Head of Advanced Care Planning for Peninsula Health here at Peninsula Health on the Mornington Peninsula. Vicky, we're through another
week. I know, it seems to go so quick, but I think it's because they're always so interesting, Brendan.
Fascinating. So Jane Luxford debuted today as well, and thank Jane very much indeed from the Village Glen in Rosebud. She was down here, and Stuart, of course, Stuart Shaw from Village Baxter was here from Plankton South as well.
That's right.
And how could we forget Tom from Encore Living, Carrum Downs?
That's right.
Without the support of our great sponsors, we would not be here, but we will be here next week, same time, for another edition of The Age Stage.
And we'll see you then.
See you, Vicky.
Thanks, Brendan.